Thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me here tonight. I especially want to thank Billy, for asking me to speak tonight. If you don't like my story tonight, you know exactly who to blame, and you can get with Billy afterwards. So, by the way, I was just looking at the map and trying to figure out where Madison, Virginia is, and I realized that I was very near your town late last year. I had gone, I'd taken my motorcycle on a nice long trip down Skyline Drive, and it was a very beautiful countryside there, and I wish that I had known about you guys then. I may have made it a trip and come out there on a Sunday night to see you. So maybe when all this is over, I will be able to do that again, because it's beautiful out there, very beautiful. So, and as a matter of fact, I was supposed to speak, I don't know, when was it, Billy? It was maybe a couple, 2-3 months ago, I was supposed to speak out there at your meeting, and my child got sick and ended up in the hospital, and I was not able to come. So fortunately, Billy was able to take care of that and get somebody else to cover for me. So finally have been able to be part of your meeting, and I'm looking forward to it a lot. Speaking on this Zoom thing is kind of strange, as most of you probably know. And I have to shut off my self view, because I definitely don't want to look at myself when I'm talking. I want to see you guys. And it's, you know, I'm still trying to get used to these Zoom meetings. It's just not the same, you know. I really don't get that spiritual connection with the people in the rooms, sitting here looking at a screen. It's much, much different when you're there in person. And that's, I'm looking forward to the day that I can come back out there. So a little bit about myself, I'll tell you. As I said earlier, my name is Mike and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is November 15, 1985. I was 21 years old when I got sober. And but I had been drinking for quite a while before that. My home group is the Big Book Topic Group here in Hampton, Virginia. And we meet on Wednesday nights. If anybody ever comes out to Hampton, please stop by and check out our meeting. We'd be glad to have you and welcome you to our group. Let me see, what can I tell you about myself? I am the only child of two foreign exchange students who came here to America back in the 1950s. And my mother came from Germany, Berlin, Germany. She grew up as a little child during the aftermath of the World War II. So she was very familiar with hardships, and she came here when she was 17 by herself, crossed the water on a ship all by herself, and started a new life here and started going to school. And my father came here from Iran. He came as a student as well, and they met in Washington, D.C., and that is where I was born, Washington, D.C., and my first 6 or 7 years, I grew up there. I really don't claim Washington as my home anymore. I really have no interest in it. The only thing that I claim from Washington is the Redskins, and I was a little child. I got interested in football and the Redskins, and I haven't let go of them, even though I've lived all over the country since then. And so that's about the only thing that I claim as far as Washington is concerned. But my parents didn't last too long as a couple. There was quite a culture clash between them. And my father ended up taking me back to his country when I was 7 years old. So as a seven-year-old and in my teenage years, I grew up in Iran. Lived with my father, and I lived with my grandmother in a large house. And every so often, a bunch of my cousins would come and live there with their parents as well. So I grew up with kids around me, even though I was a only child, but I still I don't have the experience of growing up with a sibling and having that kind of rivalry or that kind of connection to another person from a young childhood. So whether that contributed to my sense of not belonging or never fitting in or anything like that, I don't really know. It's immaterial at this point, but I was always an outsider as a child, and I didn't really make a lot of friends. Now, in those days when I was living in Iran, that was a westernized country. It wasn't like you see it today. Some of you who are old enough like me probably remember that Iran was a U.S. Ally at the time. So there was a lot of Americans in Iran in those days, in the 70s. And I went to an American school as I was growing up. And I spoke English to my father my entire life. I spoke English to him. But I had to learn to speak another language to all the rest of my family members because they couldn't speak English, so I had to learn. And so in a sense, I learned from an early life, from an early age, how to live a double life. On one hand, I lived a different life when I was around my father. And then on the other hand, I had to become a completely different person when I was around everybody else. So that was part of my learning how to interact with people. It became second nature. I'm somebody else with this group of people, and then I'm somebody else with these group of people. And I never really let people know exactly who I was. Now, I don't know if I did this consciously or it was just ingrained and it was just learned behavior. I don't really know, but that's pretty much what it was. Nobody throughout my drinking life ever really knew who I was because I wouldn't tell them. And they always saw somebody different. The first drink I took was when I was 8 years old. And my father was single. As I said, we lived with my grandmother. And my father had parties all the time. He always had women over. He had all sorts of fun going on. We lived in the basement of the house, which was very, very decked out and beautiful. And, so late at night, there was parties, people laughing, drinking, having a good time. And, of course, they wanted to get rid of the little kid that was hanging around. So I would always get something to drink from one of the girls' glasses. And I distinctly remember the very first drink that I took as an eight-year-old. I loved both the taste and the effect. The drink that I took made me feel like a different person. It made me feel like I wasn't an eight-year-old. It made me feel like a grown-up. And that's what I always wanted. I wanted to feel like something else than what I really was. And alcohol gave me that ability to do that. And I recognized that from a very young age. So from that point on, I always made it a point to hang around during parties that my dad would have, because I knew I would get something to drink. And I always volunteered to clean up afterwards as well, because I could always get something out of the leftover glasses or bottles that were left over. And then, little by little, I started stealing alcohol from the refrigerator. You know, I take a beer every day when I got home from school, or I would steal some from his stash of scotch. My dad liked scotch, so I would drink that. It tasted like shit, but it did the work, did the job, and it mattered. It started to become very routine drinking for me, and I was very good at hiding it. And frankly, I didn't really need to hide it, because it was accepted behavior as far as my father was concerned. He drank a lot, and that was his lifestyle. He was a nightclub manager, so his entire career and life revolved around alcohol, and that wasn't something that he hid from me. And by the time I was 14 years old, I became a regular drinking buddy of his. And we would drink together. He would give me stuff to drink. I suppose that was his way of bonding with me. He would share the most precious thing he had, which was his alcohol, with his other most precious thing, his son. My father was never abusive to me. He would do everything he could to give me whatever I wanted and everything that he had. So I have no complaints about my father. And I do not blame my alcoholism on him whatsoever. But the fact remains that alcohol was a very important part of our lifestyle. When I was in 1979, when I was 15 years old, the Iranian Revolution started. Some of you probably remember that. And the Ayatollah came to Iran and disposed of the Shah, the king of the country at the time. And there was a huge, huge upheaval. And there was all sorts of fighting going on in the streets. And our house was on one of the main roads of the Tehran, the main city, the capital of the country. And I would sit there in my room, looking out the window, watching the army fighting with the civilians as this revolution was going on, watching tanks go down the street, watching people getting shot and killed, and seeing this horrible stuff happening in front of my bedroom window outside, and thinking to myself, this really sucks. Where are we going to get our alcohol from now on? You know, this is the kind of thoughts that were going through my head. I was worried about where the alcohol was going to come from, instead of worrying about our lives or possibly being killed or things like that happening. You know, I was legally an American, and I was in quite a bit of danger living there during that time. And most of the Americans had left the country by orders of the president. But my father was not an American citizen, so he couldn't leave easily, which meant that I couldn't leave. So we stayed there. We stayed there during and after the revolution. You know, lots of terrible things happen, and I'm not going to get into all sorts of details about that. You can imagine what happens during a revolution, and you've seen the aftermath of the type of people that have taken over that country. But ultimately, my father, being a resilient drinker himself, he managed to figure out how to make alcohol. So he put together a still and he started making vodka out of raisins. And we had our we had a good supply of alcohol in our house. And that was, alcohol was more precious than gold by this point, because all alcohol had been outlawed by the new government, and it was, you couldn't find it anymore unless you were special people. We weren't special people, but my father was resilient enough to be able to make his own vodka, and he would not give it to anybody except for his son. So he and I would had our stash of alcohol, and we would drink that. In 1980, a year after the revolution, we managed to escape the country, and we came back to America. So I came back after missing an entire school year, and I was admitted into a private school in Pennsylvania. We came back to Washington, but by this point, I had met my mother for the first time, and my mother tried to get me into a good school. She got me into a Catholic school in Pennsylvania, in a little town called Spring Grove, Pennsylvania. Now, keep in mind, I'm not Catholic. I was not Christian. I was nothing at that point, and neither was anybody else in the family. But they decided to send me to an expensive private school in Pennsylvania. So here I am, brand new to the country, at least, as a teenager now. And I went to this Catholic school, and all boys school. And that was quite a shocking experience for me. I had never been around Catholic priests before. I didn't know anything about Christianity. I didn't care for religion, and I just was not into any of that stuff. Yet I had to go to church every day, sometimes twice a day. I had to learn all sorts of things about the Bible and about Christianity and all this kind of stuff. And it didn't appeal to me, but I had to do it. And things that happened while I was at this Catholic school, this was a very, very old, built on a hill somewhere, and there were several different buildings that were all on this big hill, all part of the school. And one day, my friend and I were in the library looking for some books for some English project that some essay we had to write. And I swear to you, this is a true story. So we are in this library, and I'm looking at the books on the wall, trying to find the one that I need. And as I'm standing there looking at these books, I notice a little button on the wall next to the bookshelf. And I'm just naturally a button pusher, so I decided to push this button and see what happens. And I push this button, and suddenly the whole wall shifts a little bit over. I called my friend over. I said, "Hey, come over here and check this out." So we came over and we started to push the wall over. And when we pushed the wall over, we could see behind the wall, there was another room. And in this room was where the priests kept all of their alcohol, all the stash of alcohol that they had. There was mountains of beer cases in there. There was all half gallon sizes of vodka and whiskey and gin and whatever you wanted. There was so much in there. And the other side of that room was where the priest's lounge was. So this was their private room where they kept all their stuff. And we had discovered their stash of alcohol. So one day we skipped out on chapel and we made a plan to steal this stuff. So we went in while everybody was in the chapel, and we took probably 10 bottles of, I don't know what it was, scotch, bourbon, vodka, whatever we could find, maybe 3 cases of beer, and we carried it all down into the underground fallout shelter that we had found, well, that everybody knew about. There was an underground fallout shelter there. So every night we would go down there into this fallout shelter and we would get piss drunk. We would get so wasted. This was something that we felt really that we had like hit the mother load. You know, this was gold. We had found the best that we could find, and it was we were the ones that had one up on everybody else. One night we went down there to get drunk again, and everything was gone. They had found our stash, the priest had, and they had taken it all. And now we were really scared because we were afraid they were going to find out that we had done it. And they never really caught us. They never, we never really got in trouble for it. But what happened was they asked my friend and I not to come back the next year. So we effectively got kicked out of the school, but after the school year was over. So now, for my 11th and 12th grade, I went and ended up living with my mother in Fairfax, Virginia. And I went to a public school from that point on. So living with my mother, whom I had, just recently met for the first time, I really didn't know her as a mother. I really did not have that respect for her as a mother because I didn't know her. But, we were trying to make a go of it. And so as a result of that, she gave me a lot of leeway and really didn't exercise any sort of authority over me. And this was the point in my life where I really needed a lot of authority. I needed some person to recognize how much I was getting in trouble and not bail me out constantly, because I was in constant trouble with the school, from skipping, getting drunk. I had discovered drugs by this point in high school, and I was getting in trouble with the law constantly, and my grades had plummeted, but yet my mother and my stepfather were not, they kept bailing me out and allowing me to continue with my behavior. And I know today that it was basically out of love, maybe a little bit out of guilt. I don't really know the entire reason anymore, but that's just what happened. They allowed me to live my life and learn from it, and to get the suffer the consequences of my actions. By the time I was done with school, I knew that I did not want to go to college. I knew that I didn't want to live at home. I knew that I didn't really want any sort of authority over me anymore. And I wanted to be able to drink the way that I wanted to drink. So I decided that I was going to join the Air Force. And I thought if I join the Air Force, then I will be able to do whatever I wanted to do. Well, my parents did not want me to join the Air Force. I was only 17 and I needed to get them to sign the papers. So I devised the plan to make them sign the papers. And my plan was that I would show them how terrible it would be if I stayed home. So I started getting wasted all the time. I was drinking a lot more. I was stealing all of their alcohol, watering down their bottles, constantly getting in trouble with the Air Force, with the police. I guess eventually that convinced them that it was a good thing for me to go. So they signed the papers and I joined the Air Force and I went in thinking that I was home free now. My first duty station was Anderson Air Force Base, Guam. And in Guam, when I went there, I was 18 years old, and this was like a paradise for a young single man. My drinking became exponentially worse than it was when I was at home. I drank constantly. I got in trouble with the Air Force a lot. I got my first DWI when I was 18 years old. And as a result, I lost my rank. For those of you who know what an Article 15 is, I got that and got in trouble and I had to do all sorts of extra duty constantly as part of my punishment. And of course, they took money away, which as a young airman, I had no money anyway, but they took future money away. So that made it even worse. but all of that happened and I just didn't really care. By that point, my drinking had become so habitual and so necessary that I figured that this was the price you have to pay to be able to drink. And I was willing to pay that price. I remember that I was going to outpatient treatment at the time. And they told me that I was not allowed to drink while I was in that program. That was supposed to be 6 weeks long. I lasted 10 days without drinking. I heard about a party that was going on that I really wanted to go to this party. And I went to my supervisor, who was also my friend, my best friend. And I told him that I was going to go to this party. And I said that I'm going to go to this party and I'm going to get drunk. And if you need to report me, go ahead and do that, because I don't really care. And I put him in a terrible position. As a friend, he didn't want me to get in trouble. As my supervisor, he was obligated to report me. And he ended up making the decision not to report me. So at some point, I successfully graduated from that treatment and moved on. When it was time for my next duty station, I was assigned Loring Air Force Base in Caribou, Maine. I don't know if anybody knows where Caribou, Maine is, but that is in the northern tip of Maine. It was 5 miles from Canada. And I got transferred from Guam in January to northern Maine. And that was horrible. Here I am, a kid from Virginia, who has hardly ever seen any snow. And suddenly I am moving from a tropical island to northern Maine in the dead of winter. And I was, my life had just completely been shattered. I knew at that point that this was going to be the end for me. I do not like the cold. I do not like the snow. I do not like anything. I'm not an outdoor person. I don't like hunting or skiing or anything like that. So the only sport, the only thing to do was to drink. And that's what I did. My drinking got really bad. I was drinking like a case of beer a night or a pint of bourbon or rum a night just to be able to deal with life. I had become so depressed. I was losing a lot of weight despite how much I was drinking because I wasn't eating any food. And my work performance was suffering, and I was getting in trouble with the military even more. I did not enjoy life. My 21st birthday came along, and at that time in Maine, the legal drinking age was 21. And I decided that I was finally going to go out and celebrate my 21st birthday outside in the town. And on the way back from town, you know, I figured, oh, it's my 21st birthday. I'll go out. I'll get drunk. Maybe I'll get lucky and find some girl. And nothing happened, of course. I had a miserable time. I spent way too much money. And I went back to the barracks where I lived. And on the way back, I got caught for my second DWI on my 21st birthday. And this time it was worse because this time I got caught by the state, not by the military. okay, so I'm going to fast forward a little bit because I'm starting to run out of time. I ended up going to treatment again. This time I went to a 30-day inpatient treatment. And I did not want to go. I told my commanding officer that I did not want to go to treatment. I did not want to stop drinking. And I wanted them to just discharge me from the military. And I did not care what kind of a discharge I got. If they gave me a bad discharge, I didn't care. I was not going to stop drinking. Well, they sent me anyway. And I went to this second treatment center, and I did not participate. I hated it there. Every day I wore my Budweiser t-shirt to therapy sessions, or, you know, I was defiant as hell because I did not want to have anything to do with these people, and I did not want to stop drinking. I was not ready to stop drinking, and I did not want people to tell me that I had an alcoholic problem because I wasn't ready to do anything about that. So when it was time to be discharged from the treatment center and go back to the Air Force base, and they told me that of all the people in my group, that I was going to be the one who drank first. And I, yes, I think you're probably right. That's what I plan on doing when I leave. And they said, for that reason, we have decided that we're going to put you on Anabuse. And I said, what is that? And they said, that is a medicine that's going to make you violently ill if you drink. And I became enraged because my plans were being blown apart. I planned on drinking the first night that I left treatment. Well, no, I could not now. When they sent me back to the Air Force base, every day I'd have to go and stand in front of the counselor and I'd have to take this pill. And it was one of the most humiliating things I ever did, standing in front of somebody and taking a pill so I couldn't drink. I was so angry. Resentful. I hated the military. I hated myself. I hated life. And I was, I kept thinking that this is not the way that I want to live. You know, it's not worth living like this. So after, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks or so, this is what happened. I remembered going to AA meetings when I was in treatment. And I remembered that I always felt somewhat comfortable in there, and I wasn't an alcoholic. So I said, you know, maybe I'll just try it. I'll go and see what it is. So one night, I found out where the AA meetings were. This was in 1985. You know, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have the internet in those days. You had to make phone calls. You had to look for flyers. You had to find AA through word of mouth or whatever it was. We had the white pages in the phone book in those days. That's where you found AA. And I couldn't drive anymore because I'd lost my license. So I walked. I walked like 3 miles at night in the snow. Well, there was a blizzard. To the community center, and I got there early. And I walked in, shook all the snow off of me, walked into the community center, and it was a long hallway. And down at the end of the hallway, I saw somebody fumbling a key in the lock of a door. And it was obviously the guy that was opening up the meeting. So I started walking down the hallway, and when I got about halfway down the hallway, I saw him snap the key in the door. He broke the key. And I realized at that point that I had come to an AA meeting looking for help, and there wasn't going to be any help for me that night. So I turned around and I started to walk back out into the darkness, not knowing what I was going to do. And the guy saw me turn around and he called me back and he said, "Hey, are you here for an AA meeting?" And I said, "Yes, I am, but it doesn't look like you're going to have one." And he said, "Oh, yes, we're going to have an AA meeting. Just come back here. When people show up, we'll end up going somewhere to somebody's house and having a meeting." And that's what we did. So my first AA meeting that I went to on my own accord ended up being in somebody's house. And I don't remember what was said that night, but I do remember the way that I felt when I left. I felt hopeful. And that was the most important thing that happened, where I felt welcome. I felt like people cared that I was there. And I felt like there was some hope to be had. And I had not had any of that stuff for several years. People didn't like seeing me anymore. People didn't want me around them. And I was miserable, all the time. You know, all the alcohol that I drank wasn't helping either, you know, being a depressant. But still, the people in AA showed me that they wanted me there. And that kept me coming back. So a few months later, maybe a month or two later, I was still hanging around AA meetings, but I was also hanging around with my drinking buddies as well. And I would drive them to the bars at night and hang out with them. And drive them back. I felt like I was doing something nice for them. You know, I wasn't drinking. I would only drink Coke at the bar with them or at the nightclub that we would go to. But I was, I was the designated driver. So I was doing a great thing. Never mind the fact that I didn't have a license, but I was still thinking that I was doing a good thing by going with my friends to the bar just to keep them from getting a DWI. Well, that night, there was a bottle of tequila going around the car on the way to the bar. And the bottle of tequila came to me the first time, and I looked at it, and I passed it on. And it came to me a second time, And I looked at it and I looked at it and I looked at it again. And then I finally passed it on. It came to me a third time. And this time I could not pass it on. This time I looked at it and I started to lift it to my mouth to drink it. And I remembered what they said in the meetings all the time. In the meetings, they would say, the day will come when nothing will stand between you and a drink, but a power greater than yourself. And I knew at that moment that I was powerless over that bottle. I knew that I could not keep myself from drinking it. And that's when I prayed to a God that I didn't believe in. And I asked this God to take this feeling away from me. And in a second, the urge to drink was removed, and a feeling of calmness and serenity washed over me. And at that moment, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol and that there was a power greater than myself that would help me to not drink. And that changed my outlook on everything. It made me feel different about alcohol. It made me feel different about myself. It made me feel different about God. And it made me feel different about life. I had a spiritual experience. And when I went back that night, I called my sponsor and I told him what had happened. And he said to me, it sounds like you had a second step experience. I'm going to come over and we're going to do the third step. And that's what happened. That night, my sponsor showed up. We did the third step and he got me started on the fourth step. And I won't get into all the details of that, but I will tell you that I have not had a drink since then. And I have my concept of my higher power has changed many times over the years. I have experimented with all sorts of things. I even became baptized for the first time in my life as an adult. I started going to church. I became very involved in church. And then I kind of backed off after a while and I don't go to church anymore. But, you know, I've had many different understandings of what God is in my life. That's not even the right word. I don't really have an understanding of what God is in my life. I have a concept of what God is, but it changes based upon where I am in my life and the influences that are around me at the time. But the bottom line is that I continue to believe in God. And that really became a very important factor for me as the years went on. I have moved many, many times since I got sober. I got sober in Northern Maine. I went back to Northern Virginia. I moved to Utica, New York. I met a lady in AA when I was 4 years sober. And we got married and we had a child. And then we moved to Shreveport, Louisiana. And from Shreveport, we moved to Pensacola, Florida. And from Pensacola, Florida, we moved here to Hampton, Virginia. And we've been here for the past 20-something years. So during all of these moving experiences, both of us, but I can only speak for myself, we had to learn to rely not only upon each other, but we had to learn to rely upon a power greater than ourselves to hold us together, to help us to raise our children, to be able to trust that God is going to get us situated in these new communities that we move to, get us involved in the fellowship to these in these new communities. I had to learn to trust that God would help me find a new job, to be able to provide and support my family. All of these things had to happen, but they had to happen in a way that I could have that faith that God was going to make things work out just the way that they're supposed to work out, and that I would be able to accept that. So during these years, you know, our relationship, my wife and I, who is also in AA, our relationship has gone up and down, up and down, up and down several times, but we've always had that common belief in a power greater than ourselves that had brought us together. And when the days, when it got difficult, we were able to latch on to that one thing that we both really believed in and turn our will and our lives over to that and work through our problems and continue to be able to stay together. You know, we recently celebrated 26 years of marriage, something like that. And we, you know, we love each other and are devoted to each other more than we have ever been. So, you know, our common trust in the plan that our higher power has for us has helped us to work through our problems and stay together. And, you know, the same is true of every other instance in our life. you know, I've had to work the fourth step, the fourth and fifth step, in many different areas of my life, not just my alcoholism. I've worked the inventory process on my alcoholism, on my smoking, on my relationship with my kids, on my relationship with my wife, on being an employee. You know, how do I apply the principles of this program to all of these areas, not just my drinking? And the inventory process has helped me to identify the strengths and weaknesses that I've had in all of those areas of my life and be able to hopefully learn from them and improve with God's help and become a better husband, a better person, a better father, a better employee, all of those things. So, you know, these aspects of my life are what the steps of AA have helped me to be able to deal with. And, you know, I am so grateful that I was introduced to AA despite my worst intentions. I did not want to be anywhere near AA. But when the day came that I was finally ready and I was able to admit that I needed help, AA was there for me. And the people in the fellowship shared what had happened to them and helped me to relate and identify with them. And it was then that I was able to actually hear the message. You know, I came here broken, and today I have the opportunity to help heal other people in the fellowship as well. I'm not one of those people that goes and collects a whole bunch of sponsees. I only have a couple right now. And it's only, I've only had two for the past several years. But that's not the point. You know, it doesn't matter how many people you sponsor. It's how many people you're willing to sponsor and how you provide your experience, strength, and hope to other people. And that's what I do today to the best of my ability. You know, despite all of the lockdown, and not being able to go anywhere, not being able to go to fellowship, you know, not go to meetings or actively help other alcoholics face to face, I still have the ability to be of service to AA. I am the alternate DCM for my district, And, you know, there's still a bunch of stuff that gets done in the background that regular AA members don't know about, don't care about, don't want to have anything to do with, but there's still the business of AA going on in the background that some people have to deal with. And that's been keeping me busy these past few weeks, not to mention my actual job, which I'm still doing from work, from home as well. So, you know, God has given me a life that I was way beyond my wildest dreams. And I still believe that everything will continue to work out as it should. And all that I need to do is conform my will to God's will. And I, you know, so far as I have done that, He has provided everything that we need and has made our life comfortable. And I really have nothing to complain about, even though I want to some days, but there's really nothing to complain about right now. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here tonight. I hope I haven't bored you too much. Thank you for being here and allowing me to speak.